Many modern churches teach that God's law, particularly the Ten Commandments, tithing, holy days, clean unclean meats, and other laws of morality, are done away in the New Testament. They think they're no longer necessary. They emphasize God's love, often accusing the God described in the Old Testament as a God that is harsh, and the God in the New Testament as a kind and loving God. They try to pit law and love against each other as polar opposites. It's either a God of law, harsh, demanding, or a God of love and kindness, who's totally different. Now, we understand that's not how we understand the Bible. But here's an example for you. Here's a quote from gotquestions.org. It's a kind of a popular website, Christian website, with answers to Bible questions. They have a section on Christians and the law. And there's a segment in there, a page that asks the question, do Christians have to keep the Old Testament law? I want to read you a little bit from that article, in just a very little bit. But the answer begins this way, their answer. The key to understanding the relationship between the Christian and the law is knowing that the Old Testament law was given to the nation of Israel, not to Christians. I will refrain from commenting on that right now for the moment. But the article then kind of goes on to shorten this a little bit. They go on to describe some of the laws, that there were laws about obeying God, about worshiping God, other laws about atoning for sin. And then in the end of that little paragraph, they make this statement. None of the Old Testament law is binding on Christians today. When Jesus died on the cross, he put an end to the Old Testament law. Period. Well, they include a couple of scriptures that they believe make their point. I'll come to those later on. But let me make a few comments here. First of all, I think we know that God's moral law was in effect long before Mount Sinai, long before the nation of Israel existed. So that statement that the law was given to ancient Israel, was it given on Mount Sinai? Yes. But was that the first time God's law appeared? Absolutely not. We know at creation, God set apart the seventh day, sanctified it, made it holy. We know that Noah understood the difference between clean and clean unclean animals. That was already well known by him. He understood that. Hundreds of years before Israel stood before God at Mount Sinai to receive the Ten Commandments as a part of his covenant with them, Abraham tithed to Melchizedek. And again, his grandson, Jacob, also lived hundreds of years before the nation of Israel came into existence and came out of Egypt. And you can read the story in the law, the Torah, about Jacob, how he had his family members get rid of their idols and their foreign gods, obviously knowing the first two commandments. You're not to worship any other god than God. You're not supposed to have any idols. In fact, we have an article on Life, Hope, and Truth that talks about the Ten Commandments before Moses. So what the article claims on this website is the key to understanding the question about Christians and the law is totally false. Was it given to ancient Israel? Yes, but it was in existence long before that. It was in existence to everybody who lived prior to ancient Israel. It was a part of the law with Israel, but it continued past the covenant with Israel. It has not ended. Now, some of the passages that are used in support of that idea, though, can be a little bit confusing. For example, Romans 13 and verse 8. Let's go to the book of Romans. Romans 13 and verse 8. Romans 13 and verse 8, God inspired Paul to write this. Owe no one anything except to love one another. For he who loves another has fulfilled the law. He's fulfilled the law if you just show love. That's all you have to do is love your neighbor. And some believe that's all that's expected of you. And this passage seems to continue, or this idea in some people's mind continues by reading a few verses later. Verse 10, love does no harm to a neighbor, therefore love is the fulfillment of the law. So on the surface, people read this and they say, oh, well, that fulfills the law. All you have to do is love your neighbor. It's the law's fulfilled. What's the problem? Why worry about all those other laws? I gave a sermon the last time I was here. Yes, that was only 3 weeks ago. It wasn't a long, long time, but it just seemed like a long time. But I spoke about hope. At Winter Family Weekend, and the sermon you heard last week from Winter Family Weekend was focused on faith. Got to thinking, you know, I talked about hope. Winter Family Weekend talked about faith. There was a third component that Paul talked about in 1 Corinthians 13 as foundational and continuing for Christianity, and that was love. So I thought, why don't I talk about love today? Seems appropriate. I had quoted that passage. Paul's statement was that love was the greatest. So let's talk about love today. Godly love. Let's talk about its relationship to law. Is it God love versus law? Or do they have place for each other? Are they contradictory? What's the relationship? Now, I guess I need to start with a little bit of a technical point. If we're still here in Romans 13, we'll see the word fulfilled in verse 8. He has fulfilled the law. And in verse 10, it is the fulfillment of the law. We have a verb and we have a noun. If you look those words up in a interlinear, you'll see that Strong's numbers, the first one, as 4137. And it's the Greek word pleiro. And there's Greek lexicon says that means to make full, to fill up. And so some people will say, well, okay, that fills up the law. That takes care of it. But if you look at what other lexicons or what lexicons also say it can be translated as, you find things like this. It means to carry out. It means to accomplish. It means to perform. It means to execute. Quite often we think of execute as meaning, okay, that's it. They're executed. That's the end. Now, execute is used in sports for an active process. You have a plan. You put the plan in motion. Do you execute or do you do not? Do you do it the right way? If so, it goes well. If you don't, something bad happens. So it's putting into practice, carrying it out. And it's that same root word in the noun form that is used in verse 10. So it would be just as accurate to say, he who loves another has performed, has accomplished, has executed the law. He's done what the law asks him to do. He is fulfilling the law in that sense. He's practicing it. He's accomplishing what it's asked. So when we think of it from that perspective, which way should we look at understanding Romans chapter 13, those passages about fulfilling the law? Well, let's look at a couple of other passages in the Bible. I think it's fair to start with Jesus Christ's words. Turn with me to Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5, of course, is part of the Sermon on the Mount, which many have recognized. Commentators recognize this as well, that this is foundational information about Christianity. These are very, very foundational points about the New Testament Christian and what's important. In verse 17, Jesus' own words said, "Do not think I came to destroy the law or the prophets. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill." Oh, pleiro in Greek, same word that Paul used in the book of Romans, chapter 13. I did not come to destroy, but I came to fulfill. For assuredly I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, one jot or one tittle will by no means pass from the law till all is fulfilled. So Jesus said he didn't come to destroy the law. He said he wouldn't do that, but he came to fulfill it. Which meaning of the word, Greek word, pleiro, applies here? How do we understand that? Well, if he didn't come to destroy, he's not doing away with it, right? I mean, that's pretty clear. And he even says in the next verse, not even a jot or a tittle is going to pass from the law till all is fulfilled. When do we ever find God saying everything's fulfilled? Well, I'll tell you where we find it. We find it in Revelation 21. Let's go to the book of Revelation. Revelation chapter 21, after Christ's return, after the 1,000 years, after the white throne judgment. Revelation chapter 21, the first few verses talk about a new heaven and a new earth. And let's skip down to verse 5. Revelation 21 and verse 5, then he who sat on the throne, this is speaking of God, he that sat on the throne said, behold, I make all things new. And he said to me, write, for these words are true and faithful. And he said to me, it is done. It's done. This is when it's done. When all things are done is when the new heaven and new earth come. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give of the fountain of the water of life freely to him who thirsts. So it's all done when we're past the millennium, when we're past the white throne judgment, and when there's a new heaven and new earth. So one jot or one tittle is not going to go away from God's moral law until that takes place. Now remember in Matthew chapter 5, I didn't read verse 19, but he goes on to say in that verse, anyone that breaks the least of these commandments and teaches people to do that is going to be the least in the kingdom. We call it least. He doesn't say they'll be there. He just says they'll be the least. And of course, he goes on then to explain about the intent of the law, that anger is the spirit of murder, breaking that commandment, that lusting after a woman is the same as committing adultery, that it is what takes place in the mind. It's the spirit of the law. So he was filling it up in the sense of giving it a spiritual meaning. That's not doing away with it. That's filling the meaning full, giving it deeper meaning, giving it even more importance. It's making it more binding, as we heard in the sermonette. We covet, we break the law of God in our minds before we do any kind of action. We do something first that breaks the law in our mind. So it makes no sense to say that Paul was talking about love doing away with the law in Romans 13 when Jesus himself said he's not going to do that. Okay, let's consider another point. Because some teach that, well, you know, okay, I get that. Jesus said he wasn't going to do it. But you know what? That doesn't mean Paul couldn't do it. Paul came after Jesus, right? Whoever comes last, that's the important person. They get to make the changes that they want. There was a pope after the one that just died. He's the current pope. He got to make some changes if he wanted to make in the Catholic Church. The next pope will get to make changes. So if Paul came after Jesus, then Paul ought to be the final authority. Now, believe it or not, I read a paper. In 1995, we were at a ministerial conference, and the Worldwide Church of God was going through its changes in doctrine, which I disagreed with. Joe Jr. knew I disagreed with it, and before I left, he caught me and handed a paper to me and said, oh, this will help you understand this stuff. Just read this paper. It was written by a former Seventh-day Adventist who had decided that the Sabbath was no longer necessary. His last name was Brimsmead, and his whole assertion throughout that paper was that Paul came after Jesus, therefore Paul had the right to change God's law. Now, you and I immediately throw that out, don't we? That's what I did with that paper. Said, no way. 1 Corinthians chapter 11, just in case we needed any confirmation of that. 1 Corinthians chapter 11, Paul says this, imitate me just as I also imitate Christ. So tell me how that gives Paul the right to say, don't follow Christ, follow me. He's telling us the exact opposite. Follow me as I follow Christ. If he was doing something different, he wouldn't want people to imitate him. He said, imitate me as I follow Christ. Notice verse 2 that he extended that even to customs in the church. He said, now I praise you, brethren, that you remember me in all things and keep the traditions just as I delivered them to you. Certainly law, but even traditions, even the church traditions, he said, you need to continue to follow. Some people think, oh, tradition doesn't matter at all in the church. Just do whatever you want. You know, we can worship God any kind of way we want to. But Paul wasn't saying that. He said, I was taught. We find that in Galatians. I won't turn there. But he said he was taught personally by Jesus Christ. And the traditions that were handed down, that were followed, he said, you need to follow those as well. Let's also take a look at chapter 7 in 1 Corinthians. I think it's important for us to take a look at this. 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 19 just gives us a little bit of a perspective of what Paul thought about the law. Now, he grew up, as we heard in the sermonette, he grew up taught by Gamaliel, one of the top Jewish rabbis, one of the top teachers of the first century. He knew the law very, very well. If Jesus had done away with it, I think Paul would be very much on top of that. He would be very well aware of what had happened. But notice what his perspective was in verse 19, 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 19. It says, circumcision is nothing, uncircumcision is nothing, but keeping the commandments of God is what matters. The commandments are what matter. So Paul is upholding the law. He's upholding God's law. It would be incredibly contradictory for him to say that here, and then a year or so later, when he wrote the book of Romans to the church at Rome, to say the exact opposite. That you fulfill the law, and that then in that sense it goes away. You destroy it. That Jesus destroyed it. It makes absolutely no sense at all. So here in this book, this letter to the Corinthians, actually was, as I said, was written about a year before, probably 55 AD, as best we can guess. We don't know exactly those dates, but probably around that time, and perhaps the next year he wrote the letter to Rome, 55, 56, one of those somewhere in that time period. Let's go back to Romans. In that year, or year and a half, whatever time period it was, did Paul change his mind? Well, let's go to chapter 7 of Romans. Only a few chapters prior to that passage in Romans 13. Romans chapter 7 and verse 7. What shall we say then? Is the law sin? Certainly not. The law isn't bad. It's certainly not sin. He said, on the contrary, I would not have known sin except through the law, for I wouldn't have known covetousness unless the law had said, you shall not covet. Yes, he stole my scripture, but that's okay, because I'm looking at it from a different perspective. Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't know what covetousness was unless the law told you, explained to you, you don't do this because it's wrong. Why is it wrong? Well, we heard that in the sermonette. Good points. But the law, he says, is not sin. The law is good. He says it taught him things. It made it clear. It's a guide. So law and love are not opposed to one another. They're actually complementary. It is God's love that gave us the commandments. It's God's love that gave us his law to explain to us the best way to live this physical life. It's his... What is it we've used in the past? It's a user's manual. I mean, he's told us how to live this life in the way that will be the best. It will have the best outcome. Now, we go through some rough periods. I'm not saying everything's perfect. We go through some rough things in life. But it's the end result that God is looking at. And the end result of doing things God's way is the best that it could possibly be. Skip down a little bit further to verse 12. Verse 12, he says, therefore the law is holy. The commandment is holy and just and good. These are not the words of someone teaching that the law is ended. These are not words of someone saying after the death of Christ they don't matter anymore. Again, this was written in the mid-50s, so at least a quarter century after the death of Jesus Christ. Had Jesus Christ done away with the law, he would have taught Paul that when he was converted. And certainly it would have been well known by the time 1 Corinthians and Romans were written, these two letters. So now that we've looked at a couple of passages from Paul, seeing that they do not contradict Christ, saying he was not going to destroy the law, let's look at another statement in Paul's letter to the Romans. In fact, this was the first verse the article I was reading from referenced when it said Jesus put an end to the Old Testament law. And it's Romans chapter 10. So let's turn there. I know we're talking a good bit about law, but we're talking about law and love, which many modern churches today feel are exact opposites, polar opposites, and antagonistic to each other. Romans chapter 10 and verse 4 says this, "For Christ is the end of the law for righteousness to everyone who believes." Okay, a quick cursory read. Christ is the end of the law. In our English language, end means stopping point, right? That's the end. So when Christ died, the law died. That's the way the thinking of much of Christianity goes these days. I think we all realize that Peter made the statement, Paul has written some things that are hard to understand. They're not surface meaning statements that he's made in many cases. And people who are unlearned twist and turn them to their own destruction. It takes help. It takes a lot of thought. It takes the help of God's Spirit to really get the full meaning of what Paul is saying. And it takes putting it together with the other passages in the Bible, not taking one passage and say, there's our answer, that's it. Christ is the end of the law. The law's ended. It takes putting it in the context of what Jesus himself said. It puts it, putting it in the context of what Paul said three chapters earlier when he said the commandment is holy and just and good. It takes putting it in the context of all of the rest of the New Testament. So how is it that Christ is the end of the law if he didn't do away with it? Well, again, a little bit of rudimentary understanding about how to figure out the meaning of Greek words is important. We look at it in English, we think end, that's it, you know, it's over. But the Greek word is a little different than simply meaning that's the end of things. If we look at a Greek interlinear, and Greek is the language that God chose to preserve the New Testament in. Yes, I know they spoke Aramaic in the first century, but God chose to record it and preserve it in Greek. If we look at that sentence, Christ is the end of the law, what word is it that causes the confusion? Well, it's that word end. Jesus said he didn't come to destroy it. Paul said follow him as he follows Christ. We've already seen that he says that Paul says, inspired by God, the law is holy, just, and good. So it's the word end that causes the confusion. What does it mean? Well, a Greek interlinear, again, chose the word as telos. And lexicons tell us this, that telos means the point aimed at. It means the goal. Now, why didn't the translators translate it that way? Christ is the end point of the law, or he is the goal of the law, or he is what the law points to. Why didn't they translate it that way? They had a choice. They could. Well, I can't read translators' mind from, what was it, 1611, King James translation. But we know everybody translates things from a certain perspective, and the perspective of the Christian world at that time in general was what I read you out of that website, that the law is ended. So, okay, it can mean end result, yes, or it can mean end. So, he's the end of the law. There we go. We'll just translate it this way and makes it easy for people to say Jesus did away with the law. But if we think more critically and put it in the context of the other verses we've already looked at, we know that's not true. He's the goal. He's the end or the point aimed at. So how is Christ the objective? How is he the goal? How is he the point aimed at? May seem a little funny at first when you think of it from that perspective, but I found our LHC article on the topic helpful because it lists us two different ways that Christ is the goal or the point aimed at. First of all, God's law defines sin. Okay, we know that. It tells us what sin is. We read Paul's comment about that. Wouldn't know what coveting was unless the law told him, explained it to him. This is what you do. This is what you don't do, rather. And because we've all sinned, not just Paul. Paul wrote about how he had sinned, but we all have sinned. The law, therefore, convicts us of the need for a Savior. If I've sinned, I've got to either pay that penalty, the death penalty myself, or I have to have someone else pay that penalty for me. That's what the law teaches me, that breaking that law, going against God's law, brings the death penalty. Paul said the wages of sin is death. So the way we get around having to pay that death penalty ourselves is by having a Savior, someone step in and pay it for us. So the law teaches us that Christ is the only one who's going to be able to do that. He's the goal of the law. He's what the law points to and says, okay, Ken, you can't do it yourself, so you can't keep it perfectly. He did, and he died, so you don't have to pay that penalty of eternal death. So in that way, he is the sacrificial death that dies in our place. He's the ultimate end. He's the objective of the law, what it is pointing to. That's one way he is the goal or what is being pointed to. A second way this article points out about being the goal or what's aimed at is God's law leads us to think and act like Jesus did. If he kept all of the law perfectly, then we're to imitate him. As Paul said, imitate me as I imitate Christ. We ought to be working to be perfect like he is perfect. Now you're going to say, you're not perfect. And you're right. But I can say the same thing to you. You're not perfect. None of us is perfect. None of us is perfect. I mean, we all do things, don't we? We do something and we say, oh, why did I say that? Why did I do that? I know that's not right. Why did I let that word come out of my mouth? Or why did I let that, whatever it was, happen? We have to go repent and ask God to forgive us for that. We all slip. We all make mistakes. Paul said, follow him as he followed Christ. The commandments teach us, yes, how to love God and how to love our neighbor. Let's go to Matthew 22. He was asked, what's the most important commandment? And he basically points out the two overriding principles of the Ten Commandments, how to love God and how to love your neighbor. Matthew chapter 22, verse 35. Matthew 22, 35. One of them, a lawyer, asked him a question, testing him and saying, teacher, which is the great commandment in the law? And Jesus said, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and the great commandment. And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. Law and love complement one another. The law tells us how to love God. The first few commandments tell us that. The rest of them tell us how to love our neighbor. How to express godly love to him and how to express godly love to our fellow human beings. Again, Jesus did it perfectly in the flesh. So he's our ultimate model. He's our goal. He's what we should be striving to be like. We'll fall short of that, but the fact that we try, that we're working for that, is what's important, that we strive to follow that goal. So that's how he's the end. He's the goal. He's the end point. He's the example for all of us. Again, I won't turn, well, maybe I should. James 1, verse 25. James made a comment about God's law. It's a law of liberty. It's not terrible, as so many today in the Christian realm try to make it out to be. James chapter 1, verse 25, God inspired James to write this. He could have written it any other way, but he makes this statement, "But he who looks into the perfect law of liberty and continues in it is not a forgetful hearer, but a doer of the work. This one's blessed in what he does." God's law is a perfect law of liberty. How is it a liberty? Because today most of Christianity says, that's bondage. You know, you have to keep the Sabbath, you have to not steal, you have to not lie, you have to, you know, be faithful to your spouse. I mean, that's bondage. You know, what horrible stuff. I'm thinking, wow. Now, okay, I'm making a little bit of fun here, because I will admit that I read the rest of the article, and after they talk about none of the Old Testament law applies, they said, of course, you know, if you love God, you won't make idols, and you won't worship anything else. And of course, you'll treat your neighbor with kindness. And of course, you will not steal from them. And of course, you won't lie. So on one hand, they make a blanket statement, and on the other hand, they come back around and they really say you really ought to be doing that anyway. So, I mean, that's what's so confusing to many people about religion today. But it's the law of liberty. It frees us from death, ultimately. Frees us from having to pay that death penalty, because it points to Jesus Christ and him paying that penalty. And, of course, it's a law of liberty in the sense that it keeps us from some of the consequences of breaking God's law. When we break God's law, we automatically bring some kind of consequence. Sometimes it might be minor. Other times it could be major consequences that we bring when we go outside of God's law, when we try to circumvent it. So how do we model Jesus Christ? If he is a perfect example of godly love, how do we model him? Well, read the book. We've got a nice book, don't we, that gives us lots of information about how to do that. A whole book of teachings about it. But since I obliquely mentioned Paul's comment in 1 Corinthians 13 about love being the greatest, those things that abide, those things that are foundational, why don't we go to 1 Corinthians 13? Because I think this is a really good passage to give us some down-to-earth pointers about how we express godly love the way Jesus Christ did. I'd like to look through this chapter, 1 Corinthians 13, at least some of it. The first few verses, the first three verses, actually talk about doing some good things, things that are good, things that can be helpful to people. But he points out that if the motivation isn't right, that the other people might be helped in some way, but the person doing it gets no benefit from it. If it's done out of pride, if it's done out of vanity, you don't gain anything from it. Remember, pride and vanity is what perverted Lucifer, turned him into Satan. So the wrong motivation is going to wipe out the benefit of doing something good for other people. So it's more than just being nice to people. It has to do with motivation as well. I brought along a book, another Bible, New Testament in 26 translations. Some of you may have seen this book or read it before or gone through it. But it's kind of interesting because it puts every verse and gives you multiple translations of other ways that you could say the same thing that would be accurate in terms of Greek. So verse 4, we start there. He says, love suffers long. Suffers long. 26 translations says, Moffat says, it's very patient. Here's one of the Phillips translation says, the love of which I speak is slow to lose patience. Slow to lose patience. How many of us are long in patience? You know, I get in a line at a store, and I love the Sam self-checkouts. And there are a lot of them now. So I look for a checkout line that has only a few people in it. And I move my buggy up there, and The person in front of me has 45 items jammed into this cart, and they're wanting to do a self-checkout. And I watch them do the first couple, and it's... And they get another object, and they turn it around, and they click that one, and they put that somewhere, and then they go find another one. Oh, this one over here, and they... No. Where is that? And they click that one, and it's like, oh, my. Okay, I'm impatient. We're in a world of instant. And it seems like either that or I pick one where there's a problem. You know, thing starts beeping, and you got to get someone over to. So how patient are we? I've got to admit, I kind of fail in that patience area sometimes. Or you get in a car line, or you get in a traffic jam. And you know, again, we live in a world of instant expectations. How patient are we when someone repeats the same story for the 10th time? Are we patient with people? Are we patient with circumstances? Well, godly love is that way. That's what Paul is telling us in this verse. It's very patient. It goes on, the rest of the verse, it says, is kind. Now, Moffat says, is gracious. Okay, it's gracious. We can also read the Phillips, looks for ways to be constructive. Okay, kind is kind of one thing in our mind, but ways to be constructive, looks for ways to help people. You know, we have a questionnaire that we send to our staff. Actually, we send it to the ministers of staff. It's a ministerial evaluation form. One of the questions that we wanted to include in that is to have the pastor answer a question. How often does this person see a need and fill it? Rarely? Occasionally? Many times? Often? Almost always. We give them a few things to choose from. Why do we do that? Well, because at camp, any of you that have served on staff at camp, you know that you have your responsibility, but often there's something that comes up over here or over there where something needs to be done, and we're looking for people who are willing to say, okay, I'm supposed to be teaching pickleball, but if somebody needs help in archery, I should go over there and help them. I should see the need. I should go help them out. Am I going to get any glory for now joining the archery staff? No. Big deal. I'm filling a need. That's the kind of people we're looking for. That's kind of what this is saying, isn't it? Looks for ways to be constructive, looks for ways to help. Just looking for that. Not looking for glory, but looking for a way to help out. Love does not envy. There are several things about this. Phillips says it's not anxious to impress. Moffat says, loves no jealousy. 20th New Century, loves never envious. You know, again, doesn't have... Can we appreciate when somebody else gets some kind of recognition? Or are we envious of that? You know, I think in general we are supportive of one another. But are we genuinely happy when someone else is recognized or promoted, even at work? You know, those are questions that we probably ought to ask ourselves. Am I behaving with godly love? Love does not parade itself. Not puffed up. It's not boastful. It's not conceited. Not putting on airs. Phillips' translation says this. It's not anxious to impress. It's not puffed up. Phillips says it doesn't cherish inflated ideas of its own importance. I know that was an interesting way of looking at this meaning. Not having an inflated idea of their own importance. It's got to be my way. And verse 5 says, does not behave rudely. Some of the other translations talk about unmannerly. They're not rude. It's not unmannerly. We live in a world of rudeness, and it just flat out is. Social media is overrun with it. People are rude to one another in the things that they say. And I read sometimes about some of the bullying that goes on social media with young people, with teens, with preteens. It's horrible how rude people are. That's not the way we should be. It's not provoked, verse 5, the next phrase says. Moffat says not selfish or not seeking its own. Not provoked, irritable, not touchy, quick to take offense. Yeah, we live in a world of people who are angry, people doing horrible things to even strangers. I can't get the image out of my head of this guy walking up in New York City and just cold clocking a guy, putting him in the hospital. I mean, what for? What did he gain out of that? It's just horrible to see people do those kinds of things. Irritable. Crime is rampant. It's mushroomed in the last couple of years all around the nation. Again, we need to be not provoked. God's people need to have a long fuse. The last part of verse 5 says, thinks no evil. Moffat says, doesn't think in terms of malice. 20th century New Testament says, keeps no reckoning of wrong. I thought that was an interesting way of looking at that. Doesn't keep a record of that. New English Bible says, love keeps no score of wrongs. Phillips doesn't keep an account of evil. Well, there are some people who are scorekeepers. Everything you do is marked up in their head. It's on a mental list if you cross them in some way. That's not the way we should be as with godly love. Should not have that approach, not focusing on evil, not thinking of getting evil or getting even with people. Now, God tells us to let him take revenge. Let him avenge us. When we were in Ohio, Mr. Myers gave a sermon on revenge. A very good message. You know, we need to not be involved in revenge. So much of movies are on that, somebody getting even. And our society seems to feed on that. Verse 6, does not rejoice in iniquity. There are two ways that's normally translated, a couple of ways that it's looked at. Not getting any joy in evil. Our society, again, seems to get thrills out of revenge, out of hate, out of evil in movies. You can see that kind of thing going on. Not being cheerful. It's another way of looking at it when bad things happen to someone we don't like. Not rejoicing in that, not rejoicing in iniquity. And the second way it's translated is not happy when someone sins or when they go wrong. New English Bible and Moffat both have those ways of looking at the verse. But instead, it says, it rejoices in the truth. It's happy when truth and good prevail. It's positive. It's glad to see others come to the truth. Others come to understand the truth of God. Looking forward to God making light prevail over darkness, which ultimately is the end result, that God will make that happen. Verse 7. And I'm trying not to draw this out too much. Verse 7 says, bears all things, believes, hopes, endures all things. Moffat says, love can face anything. That's a pretty tall order, isn't it? Can face anything. And we're all going to face some difficulties in this physical life. It's just a part of what life in this world is like. Life isn't meant to be perfect. But overall, I think God's people are hopeful and trusting in God. We see the kingdom. We press toward that. We accept the difficulties that we get along the way. We ride over the rough spots in life. We all get them. But we continue toward the kingdom of God. We're not looking for the bad, but we're looking, hoping, enduring to the end. We have so many examples of those who have gone before us. Hebrews 11 gives us a whole list of heroes of faith. So that helps us not get discouraged. And verse 8, he ends this little section with this statement about love, that love never fails. It never fails. You know, it's always, it's constant. New English Bible says love will never come to an end. Moffat says it never disappears. Never disappears. It'll always be there. God is eternal. God, we're told, is love. He's perfect in his love. Other things may pass away, but God won't. And his love for mankind, his love for his children, is never going to pass away. And no wonder Jesus made that statement about if we have that kind of love for one another, that's one of the indicators of his people, that that's what we would be like. So, you know, sometimes I think it's helpful to go through a chapter, maybe look at some other ways of translating. 26 translations, an interesting way of doing that. Just one example of a passage that expresses how we can express godly love in our life, in our everyday life. None of us is perfect in it. I get that. But the fact that we're trying for that through our life, it's a sign that we are God's people. John 13, let's turn there. Just to remind ourselves, Jesus said beginning in verse 34, John 13, 34, a new commandment I give you, that you love one another. As I have loved you, that you also love one another. Again, he's the point aimed at. He's the end result, the end point that we are looking to. As he loved us, we should try to love one another. By this all will know that you're my disciples, if you have love for one another. Again, I don't claim to be perfect in it. I know none of us is. But some of you may remember a country song with a refrain that says, I'm just an old hunk of coal, but I'm going to be a diamond one day. That's what God's looking for. He's looking to make us his jewels. We may be a little rough at this point. Diamonds are simply carbon matter that have been put under pressure and heat. So we're going to take some heat in this life. We're going to take some pressure. But if we stay the course and we keep striving to follow the example of Jesus Christ, that heat and pressure is not proof that we're hated. It's proof that God's working with us. And if we stay the course, don't get discouraged over those pressures, those troubles. Just remember the coal and the diamond. God's in the process of creating his precious jewels to be a part of his family. He was able to convert John from a son of thunder to the apostle of love. Now, that was a pretty big change. If you look at what John was like, very big change in his life. Surely there's hope for us if he can do that with him. He's given us the freedom. He's given us the right to be his children. And true godly love is the overriding family characteristic that he wants to build in us. Let's stick with the process. Let's continue to grow, work to grow in godly love.